From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. May 4th, 2020 marked the 50th anniversary of the Kent State University shootings in Ohio, when four students were killed by armed National Guardsmen while protesting the expansion of the Vietnam War. The deaths of the students, Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandra Scheuer, and William Schroeder, shocked the nation and marked what many viewed as a political turning point in America. Now, telling that story in a unique form aimed at young adults is my guest, Deborah Wiles, whose new book is called simply Kent State. Deborah is the author of several highly acclaimed books, including the beloved Love, Ruby Lavender, and two National Book Award finalists, Each Little Bird That Sings and Revolution. She's also an NAACP Book Award finalist, E.B. White Award winner, Golden Kite Award winner, Jane Addams Peace Award finalist, and the recipient of a Penn Phyllis Reynolds Naylor Working Writer Fellowship. She now joins me to discuss Kent State. Welcome to the program, Deborah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first, what is your connection to this story? This is something that unfolded in the year 1970. For younger readers, of course, this is just a piece of history that they may know nothing about. Is this a personal story for you?
It is. I was 16 years old on May 4th, 1970. Lived in Charleston, South Carolina, where my father, who was an Air Force colonel, was flying C-141 Starlifters from Charleston Air Force Base to Vietnam supplies and back with bodies. And it was from 68 to 70, he was stationed in Charleston. It was a really tough time during that Vietnam War, those couple of years. Walter Cronkite had come on television to tell us that the war was unwinnable. It had become a very unpopular war. And young people, many of them had deferments, college deferments, so they would not be drafted. But then in December of 1969, the draft lottery was instituted, and many of those in college who had 1A draft deferment or weren't 1A and had draft deferments were now going to probably be drafted if their number was low enough when it was pulled from the lottery machine. This was on our minds so much in the late 60s. And our boyfriends were going, and friends and buddies were going. And we knew we would be going off to college in another year. And then suddenly, on May 4th, 1970, everything just changed. Everything erupted. The country was stunned. I was stupefied. It was all we could talk about in school. We knew not to talk about the war at our dinner table. We knew that this was something my dad didn't want to talk about. He wasn't home very often in those 2 years, and he was grim. And yet in school, we would gather in these little cliques. Did you hear about this? Did you hear about this? Because Nixon had announced on April 30th, President Nixon, the widening of the Vietnam War after troop de-escalations for a couple of years. And he had campaigned to end the war in Vietnam. And now here he was widening it. And these college students across the country, not just at Kent State, erupted. And they were protesting and calling for change and exercising their First Amendment rights, basically. So this story was very much a part of my coming of age. And yet I didn't think I could write about it. I just thought, it's too horrible. It's too awful. So, and I began writing. Go ahead.
So just to sort of finish up what actually transpired, there was a massive protest, a very large nonviolent student protest on the campus of Kent State University, and the National Guards were called up. But I understand nobody really knew that they were armed with real firearms, and then they started shooting.
Right. That's what's so interesting, because there's a difference of opinion on that and everything else that surrounds what happened at Kent State, which is one of the reasons I've told the book the way, written it the way that I have, and told the story this way. But yes, student strikes were all, the national student strike was called for on May 1st. And across the country, students on college campuses were gathering to say, shall we join the national student strike? And this is a lot of what was going on in Kent. And it just so happened that the governor, Governor Rhodes, governor of Ohio, was up for election to the Senate. And there was a runoff election on Tuesday, and he wanted to win it, and he was campaigning on a law and order platform. And when the mayor of Kent called the governor to say, things are really dicey in our town, and we're scared, and we're worried, that's when, and the ROTC building burned on a Saturday night. No one knew why, and no one could understand what was going on or who had set the fire. The governor sent in the National Guard. And the National Guard had come from a Teamster strike with 3 days with little sleep. And they just entered and occupied the campus, and they became the law on campus. And that's when it turned almost from against the war to guard off campus. You've invaded our campus, and you are stamping on our First Amendment rights to protest, to petition, to be here and free speech.
So let's talk about your book. There have been books written about the shootings at Kent State. Yours is quite different. First of all, it's aimed at young readers. And second of all, it's written in a very unconventional manner. Tell me, how do you explain the format of your book?
Well, first of all, there's very little, maybe nothing. At the time I was proposing this book, there was almost nothing written for young people. I want to say teenagers, you know, like young adults, we call them in our business, and up, you know, that in the early 20s, that area, for about Kent State. And I talked to my editor about it, David Levithan at Scholastic. He had been my editor for the three novels I'd written about the 1960s. And every time I was researching those novels, I would come up against Kent State, and I would think, I can't write it, it's awful. And then as I finished book three, I said, there's no way I can't write it, but it can't be like those documentary novels that are so big and that have all these scrapbook sections with primary sources in them, photographs and song lyrics and advertisements and all kinds of stuff to give you context. I want this to be as quietly elegant and as eloquent as possible. So I talked to David. I said, there's no way I can't write about it now. And so he said, well, you know, let's bounce this around. And we came up with the idea of these disembodied voices telling the story. We had both just read Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders and had loved it. And I loved that idea of the disembodied voices talking to one another from different classes and races and socioeconomic and geographical backgrounds all in the cemetery one night and giving you history along the way, as well as context for the place the Civil War took in the long arc of history. And I thought I could do something like that. And David asked me the question, what about collective memory? What would you think about, you know, any historical event is told from the perspective of so many different people? And I thought, yes, if I gather all these different stories, we will have a whole. And so I went to Kent and I began researching, and I found those different stories, and I began to tell them as disembodied voices on opposite sides of the page in different typefaces and different fonts and in different size fonts, so that you will know they're genderless, they're nameless, but you'll know who the two students are. You'll know who the Black student, the Black United student is. You'll know who the National Guardsman is. You'll know who the townies are, and you'll hear all of their stories.
So did you take original quotes that you found, you know, in old newspaper clippings and other oral histories and curate them, or did you embellish and fill in holes? I mean, is this a fictionalized version or is this nonfiction?
It's both those things. I call it a novel in lineated prose.
Say that again, a novel?
A novel in lineated prose. I don't really consider myself a poet, but I can write in lineated prose. I wrote it in such a way that I wanted you to break at certain places. I wanted the emphasis to be on certain words or certain moments. So I wrote it in that way purposely. I didn't think I'm writing poetry. I thought I'm writing in such a way that puts you right there in the conversation. It puts you on May 1st, May 2nd, May 3rd, May 4th, and it delivers a eulogy for the four who were killed, and it delivers an elegy, which is a call to action for what should we do next.
So who are the various characters? I know you sort of briefly mentioned it, but just to reemphasize, there's obviously the students and voices that symbolize, I'm sure, the victims, the four victims, but then there's different kinds of students. There's the white students, there's the black students. There's the university, there's the town that the university and the voices of the locals, right? And then there's also the National Guardsmen.
Right. There's all those voices. There are three students. Two I imagine is white. One I know is a black student, and it comes directly from some of that research that I did. I listened to so many oral histories and read them and went through so many different boxes in the archive of material, even from the police department, that showed they were clearly racially profiling black students. And finding out who they were and were they politically active, and if they were, how, and who were their parents. And there were quotes from them in these oral histories saying, see a white man in the uniform standing there holding a rifle and you don't think there are bullets in it? Get real. And yet there are also quotes from white kids who are saying, we knew they didn't have bullets. We never knew they had bullets. We thought they were blanks, if anything. They were just a show of force. But black students knew different, just as they do today. And right. So that was part of the direct line I wanted to draw between then and now. But getting ahead of myself, also stood there. Actually, I remember standing up straight as I had been sitting and sifting through letters to the editor, to the local paper, after May 4th, 1970. And I came across one handwritten that said, from a townie, from a person living in Kent, that said, you should have killed more of them.
Wow.
And that's a direct quote that goes into the book. So I've embellished, I've also used direct quotes, but I stood straight up. And the archivist said, are you okay? And I said, not really. And there were many of those letters. Many of them saying they ruined our town. Our town will forever be scarred by this, and not realizing that there were four dead students, nine wounded students, lives were changed forever. And there were even National Guard oral histories given anonymously that were saying, we didn't want to be there. We were young and we were auto workers or we were rubber plant workers and we were students. Some of us were students here at Kent, and we had joined the National Guard in order not to be drafted. And yet here we were holding rifles with bayonets and facing our fellow students.
It seems as though what happened on that campus that day 50 years ago was essentially the war come home, right?
It was. It definitely was. It was the state killing its children. Unarmed children in their schoolyard.
And so for young Americans today to think about that history, what do you hope they get from your book? Because of course, for a young person reading history that is written in a traditional format, and even for grown-ups, might be a little bit on the boring side, your eyes might glaze over. It seems as though your book really dramatizes it in a way that it almost feels like reading a play.
That's really a good way to put it. I see it as reader's theater. I see it as a staged play. I see it as being read individually or in a class. I see it as there are many ways in that teachers or parents or young people themselves, or just an adult who wants to know more about Kent State, will have with this book of being able to say, oh, here's what happened and here's how we can use this. We can use it in a classroom or in a community theater. But I don't feel like it's eyes glazed over boring, because what I think it does.
No, I meant to suggest that a traditional history book might glaze one's eyes over as opposed to this.
I gotcha. Yeah. What I think it is that it puts you in the moment because of the way it's written, back and forth, and argument, basically. Yeah. And the goal of the argument, in my opinion, is to show you that the facts aren't always what you think of as the facts, that people disagree with what the facts are, and that sometimes the history cannot be proven to show you what the facts actually were. Was an order given to fire? Who burned down the ROTC building? There are many, many questions that still are not able to be definitively answered. So to show history as a collective memory, but also as a way to stop the shouting for a moment, because that's what they do in this book, back and forth, the townies, the students, the National Guard, the Black United student, who's trying to give them the arc of history. They argue until they get to a point where they can stop for a moment, take a breath, and agree to listen. And that was another goal for this book, is I'm very cognizant right now of the deep political divides in this country and of our the deep arguments that are going on, the polarization that in this country right now, long before COVID too. I mean, we've just been building and building and building, in my opinion, really, in a way, since Kent State and since Watergate and since the 80s, we have been building toward this crescendo of people not able to listen to one another because they are so desperate to be heard. And in my opinion, a government that's of the people, by the people, for the people, is a government that knows its citizens deserve to be heard and not to be yelled at constantly or told this is the way it's going to be. Let's listen. Let's have a dialogue. Let's have a conversation. I feel like we've forgotten that.
Right. And so there is so much relevance today to, in terms of what happened 50 years ago. Did the shootings at Kent State mark this turning point? Did you find that after that moment, our politics were set on a path that ended up in, you know, even greater polarization, or was it just a point along a lengthy arc of polarization?
That's a good question too. I think it's both. Hmm. I think that the shootings at Kent State, and remember, this was 3 days of ratcheting conflict that was going on between the students and sometimes the school, the administration, but then when the National Guard came in between the students and the guard, that just exploded on May 4th when the students were screaming at the guard and the guard was coming towards students and things got out of hand. And the book goes into much more detail about how that actually happened. But those shootings, 67 shots in 13 seconds, wow, that killed 4 students, wounded 9 more, and actually was the end of the 60s. It marked the end of the 60s and the beginning of a brand new way of looking at politics, a brand new way of looking at First Amendment rights, and a brand new way of looking at how we handle dissent in this country. And it also, to the other part of your question, it also takes its place, Kent State, and that massacre takes its place way, way back in a long arc of history. Laura Davis, who is professor emeritus at Kent now and was also a witness she was there during the shootings as a student on May 4th, 1970, was part of the team that put together the National Historic Landmark nomination for Kent State. She gave me that as part of my research, bless her heart, because it was crucial to me to be able to see this arc of history, and they had to paint it in order for Kent State to be named a National Historic Landmark. So we can go all the way back to the Boston Massacre in this country. We can go to Wounded Knee. There are other markers that get us to Kent State, all examples of government overreach. And from there, we can go forward. We can go forward to, let's say, even more recently, the Dakota Access Pipeline. We can go to separating families at our borders. There are many instances of not only government overreach, but permission given by our government because of that overreach for others to act independently. So I draw a line in Kent State to even, and this is the bus student helps us with this, the Black student in the book, from slavery to mass incarceration, to mass shootings, to lone gunman shootings, to school shooting. You can see an arc when you begin to look for it. So Kent State has a lot of work to do in a very short, slim volume.
did the shootings at Kent State, was that the first time that a university campus had a mass shooting? And of course, it would be different from the kinds of, that was state violence as opposed to a lone gunman. But was that the first time that we had this sort of event?
That's the first time that it's, the guard was actually on Ohio State's campus 4 days earlier and had been there for a different reason, but the Kent State, the Nixon speech on television, April 30th, brought 4,000 students out at Ohio State, and there was some shooting and some were wounded, but the governor, once again, Governor Rhodes, quashed that, made that so quiet. No one was killed, but there were injured. And then they were sent to, I'm not sure if it was the same group that did the Teamsters strike, but that then went to Kent State. And Kent State was where it erupted into murder. So this was the first that we know of, yes, the government intervention.
You write pretty unflinchingly in your book about the deaths at Kent State, how the students were shot. Are you worried that, would that traumatize young readers? I'm thinking of my preteen child, maybe at age 14 and older, it might not, but how do you tell the story of such brutality and trauma to young kids without traumatizing them?
I think you can tell the truth in many different ways. And it can be appropriate for whatever age you're telling it to. The truth is what's important. It's just like when you have a small child who wants to know where babies come from, whatever it is, for a four-year-old or a six-year-old or then a 12-year-old. For instance, I wrote a book called Freedom Summer. It was my first book. It was a picture book meant for elementary school kids, and it's been used all the way through college now, about two boys who want to go swimming at the town pool when it opens to everybody under the sun, no matter what color, in Mississippi. And I had this experience because I spent summers in Mississippi where my parents grew up and took us back every summer. And when they get there, the pool's been filled in with tar and closed. And that's a way of talking about the civil rights movement. And it's a way of talking about friendship and justice and fairness and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that's appropriate for certain ages. But then you get to Revolution, which is a book I wrote in the 60s trilogy, which goes into much more detail and is more traumatic about what happened in Greenwood, Mississippi during the summer of 1964. But for Kent State, I think it's definitely, definitely young adult. So I look at it as definitely over 14. It may tip into middle school, but it's most definitely high school and above. And I don't spare the reader because it is traumatic. And
the students that were there on that campus weren't that much older than the
they weren't, and they weren't spared, and neither was I. I was 16, and I saw the cover of Life magazine, and I saw Time, and I saw Newsweek, and I saw the news on television, and it was horrific. And the news, the Vietnam War came home to us every night on television. It was also horrific. And I'm not saying that that scarred me and gave me a PTSD moment that I'm going to always live through, but look how it's informed everything that I write. And I think that what we do is we take those social justice issues or those cultural issues or racial, whatever those issues are that affect us growing up. Like, I grew up a child of the South and a child of the military, and I write about all that. I think those stories stay with us. It's like Patricia McLaughlin said, what you know first stays with you. And she's a wonderful writer for young people, and it's a wonderful sentiment, and I think it's very true.
Well, Deborah, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and spending this time with us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate it.
My guest has been Deborah Wiles, the author of several highly acclaimed books, including the beloved Love, Ruby Lavender, and two National Book Award finalists, Each Little Bird That Sings and Revolution. We've been discussing her newest book aimed at young adults called simply Kent State. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.